Well, welcome to session three. This is Money, Stewarding Our Finances with Eternity in View. And if you missed the first 2 weeks that Brian did, the audio and outlines are available online. Please check those out. He laid a great foundation. Our theme verse has been 1 Timothy 6:6. Now there is great gain in godliness with contentment. Contentment is huge. It's so important as a foundation. And this very profound quote by Jim Elliot has also helped us. He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. It's amazing that God gives us eternal rewards for the way we invest our temporal gifts and finances. That's just how gracious our Lord is. The book we've been recommending is this one by Randy Alcorn, The Treasure Principle. This is one of those, I dare you to read it, kind of books, because it may change your life. The Treasure Principle, simply stated, is you can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. So that's definitely a worthy read. So Brian talked about generous Christians and avoiding worldly pitfalls. I'm going to be covering planning carefully this week and saving strategically next week. I've got a lot of material, but I want to allow some time for Q&A at the end. This is probably going to stimulate a lot of questions, so I will try to save some time for questions at the end. So we're going to get practical, talk about how to apply stewardship. I'll be specific and detailed, and this is less of a broader theological foundation than Brian laid for sure. We'll get to crunch some numbers and hopefully have some fun. Do math in the morning, so. But let me make a couple qualifications here to make something clear about what we're not doing. We're not we're going to get practical, but it's no less spiritual or biblical. We're not moving from the spiritual to the secular. So because God is sovereign and owns everything, and we are stewards of his resources, financial activity is spiritual activity. And that's true with other areas of life, like our time, our bodies, our gifts and talents. So this is still spiritual stuff, not secular. And plus, we always want to be doers of the word. Faithful disciples put the word into practice. James 1:22 says, "But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves." It's possible to come to a class like this or listen to a Sunday sermon and think that by hearing only you've changed. But usually change happens after we get home and go to work by the grace of God. That's what I found anyway. So I'm going to encourage you to do some work when you get home based on this morning. But of course, let's be motivated by grace. And I like this quote from the ESV's Study Bible. Being doers of the word and not hearers only is the only proper response to the word of God. Not only the gospel, but the entirety of scripture, allowing it to take root in one's life. I know that change in this area can be hard for people. You may have bad habits. Maybe you were never taught. But with God, all things are possible, and he will help you as you apply the word and try to let it take root in your life. You know, by faith through grace, of course. The other qualification is hopefully balancing out what I just said. On the other hand, we're not emphasizing practices over principles. Principles are more important than practices. There's a variety of ways to practice faithful stewardship. I'm going to suggest some. I'm going to be pretty detailed. But you may find something very different, more helpful to you. And that could still represent very faithful and wise stewardship. You know, principles that are clear and apply to all of us would be things like stewardship, giving, contentment, faithfulness. But how you practice that can be very flexible. And plus, we're all at different places based on age or circumstances or even just levels of prosperity. You know, in the kingdom of God, there's economic diversity. We all have different gifts, we have different talents, different callings, there's different levels of material blessing. So, hopefully those will help set the stage a little bit to make it clear what we're trying to avoid as I get specific. All right, let's dive into planning. So let's say you go to a new shopping mall you've never been to before, one of these huge mega malls, and you walk in the door and you don't know where the store is that you're looking for. How do you find it? Normally you go to the marquee at the entrance, there's a map on there, and you look for the arrow or the red star that says you are here. In finances, we need a you are here moment, and we need to know where we are before we can know where we need to go. I like Proverbs 27:23, know well the condition of your flocks and give attention to your herds. In the ancient Near East, you know, wealth was often measured in livestock. You know, now it's bank accounts and retirement accounts and houses and cars. But the point is that we're supposed to know what we have and what condition it's in. So the place to start there with finances is a personal balance sheet, or sometimes called a net worth worksheet. If you were to come to me asking for financial counseling, I would ask you to fill out this form ahead of time. If you went to see a financial planner for investment advice, he'd probably want to see this information. If you were looking to evaluate a company to buy stock or maybe work for, this would be a good evaluation tool. For those of you who are students, this would be like your cumulative GPA for your entire life, actually, financially. The personal balance sheet is simply a snapshot of what you own versus what you owe at any given point in time. So every financial transaction you've ever made has resulted in an asset going up or down or a liability going up or down. And one thing I like about accounting and finances is that the numbers can actually tell a story and provide meaningful information. We're not just putting numbers on a page. We want the numbers to inform us, guide us, tell a story, and help direct the future. So turn to the personal balance sheet. I think the best way I can explain this is just walk through an example here. And you can do this on your own when you get home. So I made these numbers up. This is a fictional couple, John and Jenny. These numbers could be real, though. They're normal. This could easily be a real situation. So assets go first. Assets are simply things that are owned. Of course, in the kingdom of God, they're his possessions in our care that have value. So the obvious one would be a checking account, a savings account, any other kind of cash, investments, bank accounts are obvious and probably the easiest to figure out. If you have a retirement plan, put the balance in there. Any other investments, note them. If you own a home, you can get the market value online from a site like Zillow.com. That's Z-I-L-L-O-W. Put down your cars, what you think they're worth. If you need to get an estimate of their value, you can go to KellyBlueBook.com. That's KBB.com. And then personal property is just clothes, furniture, stuff. Just be conservative and don't try to overvalue your stuff. I'd assume garage sale kind of value. And in this case, this couple has $227,000 of total assets. And then list the liabilities. Liabilities are simply debts that are owed. And just list them all, no matter how big or small, whether they're personal or more formal. So they own a home, so as you would expect, they have a mortgage. So they owe a balance of $185,000 on the mortgage. And there's a car loan, a student loan, and a couple of credit cards. Also with the debts, it's helpful to note the interest rate and the monthly payment for reference and for planning. So the total liabilities are $245,000, and so the net worth is a negative $18,000, which is normal in America. 80% of Americans owe more than they own. It's not good, it's just common. And so at the bottom, there's a number of questions we can ask of any balance sheet. And when you get home and do yours, you can ask yourself these questions. Is there negative net worth? In this case, yes, there is. It's negative 18,000. So we want to reverse that trend. Are there upside down or underwater assets? What that means is you could not sell the asset to pay off the debt. So for example, the car is worth $10,700, but the balance on the loan is $12,500. So they couldn't sell the car and pay off the loan. That's called upside down or underwater. Is there enough savings? Probably not in this case, but they have $1,000 in a savings account, and that's not a bad start for an emergency reserve. We'll get to this in a minute, but $1,000 at least for emergencies is where you want to start. The idea is $1,000 covers most emergencies. If you have a car repair or a home repair or you get hurt and miss a few days of work, hopefully it'll get you through without you having to go into more debt. Has retirement savings been started, if applicable? Yes, in this case. So that's certainly a strength of this balance sheet, that they have some retirement savings going through work, $5,000 worth. Is there unsecured debt? That's debt that also can't be offset by an asset. So the home would be secured debt. They could sell the home and pay off the mortgage. That's secured, but unsecured would be the student loan or the credit cards, and the car would be, I guess, partially secured. Can any assets be sold or liquidated? Sometimes we have stuff to sell that we should go ahead and sell and pay debt off with. So maybe these stocks, the $3,000, maybe a relative gave them that years ago and now they can sell it and pay off some debt. Maybe they have some household items sitting around that have value that are unessential and can be sold and pay off some debt. So you're always looking to economize your assets and make the best use of them. And then lastly, can any interest rates be reduced or loans refinanced? You know, the interest rates in this example aren't really the problem, so that's not where I would focus, but perhaps they could consider that. All right, let me comment on the credit card debt here briefly. Brian did a good job talking about debt and some of the false assumptions we can make that cause debt. Proverbs 22:7 says, "The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is slave of the lender." And if you've been in debt, I think you can relate to that, and it is a form of bondage. You know, the obligation is real, and we're stuck. And sadly, in our culture, the credit card companies and the banks want us to stay that way so they can maximize their interest. So I just wanted to show what would happen if you only made the minimum payments on these credit cards, which is what they would want you to do and all that you'd be required to do. So on the Visa card, if you make the minimum monthly payment, which is $55 a month to start, on this $2,500 credit card balance at 15% interest, it would take over 16 years to pay that off. And you would pay an extra $2,600 in interest over that time. So you pay back more than twice what you borrow. And the Discover is even worse because the interest rate is higher. The minimum payment there at 23% would take you 23 years to pay off, and you pay $8,900 in interest over that time. So it's just a killer, and I'm not anti-credit card. We have a couple, and we use them for certain types of expenses. I'm mainly anti-overspending and anti-consumer debt. So, but I think they're fine under a couple conditions. Number one, that you pay the balance off every month without paying any interest. If you can do that and it's just a method of payment and a way to manage your cash flow, that's fine. And number two, that you don't spend any more than you would otherwise if you had to pay cash for that item. It's just so tempting with instant gratification to want something now and pay later, and we tend to overspend by as much as a third, some studies say. But if you can resist that, and again, it's just a way to pay for things conveniently, then there's some advantages. But if you do have credit card debt, I'd say that's probably your first goal, is to look at paying that off and quick. All right, well, let's talk about planning. And what I mean by planning is two basic things: goal setting and budgeting. And budgeting is actually just a type of goal setting. So why set goals? What's the advantage? What's the point? Well, here's a few. They provide direction and purpose. They help define your priorities. They provide personal motivation. And they help express God's will. Your senior pastor is a goal setter. I'll tell you that. He's always been. I remember years ago he would do the roles and goals process that is in some book that I forget now. But he would go through the roles of his life: Christian, husband, father, pastor, set goals for each. And one of our roles as believers is a financial steward. I have an acronym called SMART goals, S-M-A-R-T, that I borrowed from a friend of mine, Tom Wirth, who taught a class like this. I think if you're going to have a goal, let's make it count and make it work for us. S is specific. So that means written and, you know, sufficiently detailed. The January issue of Money Magazine said that you're 41% more likely to hit a goal just by writing it down. M is measurable. You need to know if you hit it or not. A is achievable. You don't want to frustrate yourself with goals that are too high too soon. On the other hand, R is realistically high. You want them to be a stretch. And T is timed, so there's a deadline or a closed end to it. So I'll give you a few suggestions that you can set yourself today if they apply. I got my training through Crown Financial Ministries, so I'm what they call a Crown Money Map Coach. And Crown has a series of destinations that you travel through on your financial journey through life. You may be familiar with Dave Ramsey. He has what he calls baby steps. And step one for both of those ministries is pretty much exactly the same, and that's save $1,000 towards the emergency fund and establish a written budget. So a goal might look like this. My goal is to have at least $1,000 saved as an emergency reserve by June 30th, 2015. Or the third one there, my goal is to establish a spending plan by June 1, follow it for the month of June, and send a report to an accountability partner by July 5th, 2015. Those would be examples of these SMART goals. And I think we should celebrate when we hit a goal. You know, reward yourself a little bit. Keep yourself motivated. All right, we're going to move on to budgeting. And I find it helpful when thinking about budgeting, especially spending, is that there's really only five ways to spend money. I'm sure there's other ways to look at it, but I think these five ways capture it all. And the relationships between these categories and the percentages are important. So we can give our money away, we can save it, we can pay our taxes, we can repay debt, or we could spend it on our lifestyles. And I've given some percentage breakdowns there of what may look good and not so good. And the someday maybe column is kind of my dream. I'd love to give half my income away and live off 25% of it. But one thing to point out is, if you notice the living expenses percentages, we need to learn to live off of about half to two-thirds of our gross income. That's about what we have to spend. And of course, the more debt we have to repay, the less we can give or save or live on. the more taxes you pay, the less you have to give or save or live on. So again, you're looking to kind of maximize and be efficient here. Now, your debt repayment percentage may be huge right now if you're trying to pay off debt, and maybe it should be huge if you're trying to pay off debt. So these percentages represent like an ongoing trend, not a short-term goal. You might spend a quarter or half of your income if you're seriously trying to get out of debt. If you want some suggestions on spending percentages for various categories, there's budget guidelines at sites like crown.org or daveramsey.com. Here's a couple of book suggestions, actually. This is from Crown Financial Ministries, Howard Dayton, Your Money Map. That's a good one. And then this is Dave Ramsey's Total Money Makeover. That's also very good. So you'll find these destinations and baby steps in those books that I mentioned. All right, let's move on to spending here. Kind of like we did with the personal balance sheet, where we had to take stock of where we stand, we need to also take stock of how we're currently spending before we can know how to establish a budget. I mean, you can try to implement a budget from scratch tomorrow, but I think it would serve you better if you took some time just to track things and find out where they're going in the first place, and then you can adjust and budget them. So we can move on to the monthly income and expenses sheet. This is the same fictional couple, John and Jenny, and as you may have guessed, based on the debt they have, they're spending more than they earn. And, you know, this is arithmetic, not rocket science. There's only two solutions, right? Raise the income or lower the expenses or some combination of both. It really is that simple. And sometimes I think stating the obvious might be helpful. So let's look at the monthly income, the top section there. You want to put down your gross salary, any other income you have, rental income, part-time work, if you have business income or investment income, whatever is significant. And in this example, they earn $5,000 a month or $60,000 a year. That's average for the Louisville metro area. You may not be able to relate to that. Maybe you can't imagine having that much money to live on, or maybe you can't imagine having that little to live on. So I had to pick a number, so I just picked something that was average for our area, for a household. And then list the deductions that come out of your pay, income taxes, federal, state, local, and FICA. There was a retirement contribution we saw from the balance sheet, so here's 3% of the gross income going into retirement. That's good. There's a deduction for some medical insurance through work, probably. So the deductions are $1,250 and the net monthly income is $3,750. Again, we're not budgeting yet, we're just getting reality down on paper. And so then you list your monthly expenses, and this may take some work. You'll have to go back through your banking records, credit card statements. Does anybody still use a paper checkbook register? All right, well, I won't tell you to go back through your checkbook register. They're pretty much obsolete. So, and just fill in the blanks here as best you can. There's giving, housing, food, auto, debt, and medical. The left side of the expenses section, those would be the essential ones that are non-discretionary, more or less. Ones that we don't have as much choice about or flexibility in. The ones on the right, the personal, clothing, gifts, savings, and other, those would be the discretionary ones where there is some flexibility, and this is where you're going to find your cuts most of the time. So they're spending $900 more per month than they're earning. And if they're like a lot of couples that I've actually met with, they may actually have not realized this until they went through this exercise. They may just have the feeling that things are tight and we have to keep pulling out the credit card and we're never getting ahead, and there's just a sense of frustration. But seeing it in reality on black and white can help and is the important first step. So how are they going to eliminate this $900 deficit and even try to create some kind of surplus so they can pay this debt off? Well, that's the hard part. But again, the only two choices are increase the income or decrease the expenses. Now, the personal discretionary expenses, those aren't too hard to cut. I mean, sure, it's a sacrifice, but if we have to quit dining out, we're not going to die. But they're going to have to live a simple, basic lifestyle without a lot of frills. But I also don't want to ignore the other side, getting the income up. I think as Christians, we can shy away from encouraging people to work more and make more money to offset their situation, even if that's in the short term. You need to be wise. You need to maintain balance. You don't want to sacrifice your relationships, your spiritual health, all that. You need to do this with counsel. But if you need to take on a second job for a while to pay off some debt, you can do anything almost for 6 months or a year. And so I just don't want to dismiss that, even though you should look at both income and expenses. And you may be trying to break spending patterns you've had for your whole life. So I realize this is not easy. But the Lord is with us, and you can pray for self-control. One of the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians 5 is self-control. And you can pray for that, and by the Spirit, He will increase that. All right, so we know what we've been spending. We know some of the changes that need to be made. So now it's time to actually put together a budget and use it. I'm at number 8. A budget or spending plan is simply a plan for allocating your finances and defining how they will be used. Many people don't like the word budget. It's gotten a bad connotation, maybe. It just sounds so constraining and distasteful, like a diet. So use the term spending plan if you prefer. So here's some reasons I think a budget is worth the effort. It reveals areas of overspending, holds us accountable, measures progress toward our goals. Again, we're not just putting numbers on a paper as some kind of mathematical exercise. This is a means to an end. We're trying to go somewhere. And the budget is a means to helping us further our stewardship. It strengthens communication between spouses. If you're married and if you have a budget, you have something to talk about all the time. in a good way, so. At least once a month, when the month is over, sit down and look at how you did. Where did we do well? Where did we do not so well? Where do we need to adjust? Finances are a major source of conflict in marriage, Christian or not. And having a plan will give you something to focus on and stay on the same page with. And please, husbands, this is an exhortation to husbands. Even if your wife tracks the details, pays the bills, maybe is more gifted in managing things that way, you still have to lead, set the tone, be involved, take responsibility for the budget and goals. Sometimes we can expect our wives to multiply loaves and fishes like the Lord did. So just make sure your wife is cared for and covered and protected. A budget leads to financial freedom and relief of financial stress. I'll give you an example. Lisa and I have had a date night almost every week for the last 23 years. And that's in our budget. And we don't have to wonder if the money's there. We don't have to feel guilty about going out to eat. We can go out and enjoy each other's company with faith and not have to think about it. The Lord has called us to that. The Lord has provided that in our budget, and we do it freely and joyfully. You know, if we had to think about whether or not we had the money every week and how much is too much, and it just would take a lot of the fun out of it. So I think a budget can produce a lot of freedom. And lastly, it pays. If you spend some time on your finances, it will pay off financially. Once things are in order, it'll take a while to get it into order, but once they are, if you spend an hour a week probably, I would venture to say you'd pay yourself at least $50 an hour in the savings and economizing that you would accomplish. Let her be there. I like Proverbs 21:5, one of my favorite verses about budgeting. The plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. I like that planning and diligence are both mentioned there. I've seen some beautiful budgets on paper that people, you know, put on paper and never look at again, never use. Again, this is a tool to inform us that can help us make decisions that we can respond to and adjust to. So a plan without diligence won't work, and diligence without a plan will be unproductive. And please keep it simple. You'll have to find something that works for you, but you need to find something that's simple. Don't overcomplicate things or you'll get frustrated and want to quit month one. So what is a budget exactly, and how is it supposed to function? Well, basically, we need a way, as an example, to say and to answer, my plan is to spend $100 on dining out per month. So that's our goal, that's our plan, that's our budget. And then we need to be able to answer, well, let's say it's the middle of the month, how much have I actually spent so far? And then at the end of the month, how did I do overall? And I think looking at things on a monthly basis is very helpful. Just take it a month at a time. So these are attempts at bar graphs. So the $100 per month dining out budget is depicted there in two parts. This is the middle of the month, let's say the 15th. So it's the middle of the month, and it's date night. How do we know what we have to spend? Well, I could look at my system and see that I spent 65 and I have 35 left. That means I have to slow down for the second half of the month, right? And spend less or eat more simply or go out for coffee instead of dinner. And then at the end of the month, I need to know how I did. And in this example, we blew past the $100 and were over budget and actually spent a total of 150. So that means I have some work to do, some tightening up, and next month you can try to do better. There's grace for all of this. We get a fresh start every month is the way I look at it. So there's all kinds of tools out there to track money and compare it to a budget these days. You know, the web and technology have made it easier than ever, although there's almost too many choices in some ways. But you can do it on paper and add it up by hand or by a calculator. The examples I have are Excel spreadsheets, and these blank Excel forms are going to be online at the church website, by the way. There's software like Intuit Quicken or Microsoft Money. There's good web-based tools like envelopes.com or mint.com. And Dave Ramsey has a brand new one called everydollar.com. And there's probably tons of mobile apps out there that I'm not really familiar with, but I know they're out there. Well, let's look at the monthly spending plan, which should be your last page, I believe. So no matter what system you use, this kind of process is going to be going on in the background, whether you realize it or not. So this is John and Jenny's monthly spending plan. The first five columns are just like the old-fashioned checkbook register. again, that nobody uses anymore, but that's the format. There's a date, a description of who it was paid to or received from, a check number and amount, and then the balance. And I recommend you do all your spending out of one checking account, and so this sheet would tie to the checking account balance. So if you're doing that anyway, the only other extra step is to move to the right side of the page and enter each expense in a budget category column. The budget amounts are at the top. So they've balanced their budget, and they're now spending exactly what their net income was, which was the $3,750. So we've just skipped through, you know, months of hard work and blood, sweat, and tears, and they've figured out a way to balance their budget. Maybe they paid off some of that debt. But that's all there is to it, is to enter each expense in the appropriate category column. So they pay the mortgage there on June 2nd. That goes in housing. If you look at Walmart on June 4th, sometimes you have to subdivide your expenses and break it up into multiple categories. You can buy almost anything at Walmart, right? So they spent money in food, on personal items, clothing, and gifts. And down at the bottom, it all gets tallied at the end of the month and compared to the budget. And so the last row there is how they did, good or bad, against their budget. They spent $71 more. And they did okay in some areas and not so good in others. There's the personal category was still over by quite a bit, so they're probably still wrestling to get that under control. They did well in auto and a couple of the categories that were under budget. So I'm not that worried about little variances month to month, as long as the big picture is mainly on track. Again, be patient with this. If you've never done something like this, it'll take a while. And involve somebody else. I think as believers, this is one area we don't share like we should, and I think more transparency could help us. I know in community groups that I've been a part of in the past, at times we've all brought our financial reports and compared them and showed them to each other. We brought a personal balance sheet and our income and expenses and went around the room and let others in on that part of life. You know, you need discretion there and confidentiality, of course, but it's part of community, and so I'd encourage us to consider helping each other more. Well, I think I'm about done.